My attention went immediately to the big white house at the end of the cul-de-sac and stayed there until I climbed into the unmarked car's back seat. "Alex, I wish we were seeing each other under better circumstances," said the petite woman sitting sideways in the front passenger seat. Omaha Police Detective Jan Sargent had aged little since I'd last seen her, 7 years before. "I do too, Jan," I said. Sargent's partner, Brian Box, sat behind the wheel, looking straight ahead with an expression I remembered. Box had gone gray since I'd last seen him, but he still looked as if he'd bitten into something that didn't taste quite right. I'd met the two detectives 18 months after a brutal mass murder had taken place in that white house on the cul-de-sac before us. The Daly family of Omaha, Calvin, Bee, Ross, Sharon, and Janet, were found dead in their home 2 nights before Christmas. Their throats had been cut with a scalpel or razor. I'd gotten involved after a second mass murder in suburban Fort Worth, the Monahan family, Alice, Bill, Kenzie, Monroe, Annie, and Brent were found at home with their throats slit. I'd worked the case for the FBI, but ultimately had been unable to push the investigation beyond a psychological profile I wrote of the unnamed suspect. "We couldn't have done this over the phone," said Box. "I thought you'd want to hear it in person, Box," I said. And I needed to see the scene again, and I wanted Detective Aaliyah to see it as well. "We're not going in there and upsetting those people without cause," Sargent said. "No need to go inside. We can do this from here." "So, out with it," Detective Box said. "Tell us about B. Daly," I said. Box shrugged, said, "Nice woman, housewife, devoted to her husband and her kids. Did charity work, PTA, that sort of thing. But quiet." "What about before she married Calvin?" I asked. Sargent said, "I believe she was born in Helena, Montana, and attended the university in Missoula before marrying Calvin." "Next of kin?" Aaliyah asked. "Dead, as we understood it," Sargent said. "This is about B?" "She's the key," I confirmed. "She's the reason her entire family was murdered that night." "You have proof of that?" Box said, turning in his seat for the first time and looking highly skeptical. Aaliyah and I told them about Thierry Mulch and his runaway mother, Lydia. Then we explained that Ava and Gloria Jones had searched for Mulch's mother on Ancestry.com under both her maiden and married names and gotten nothing. But then, remembering that Atticus Jones had thought the man she'd run off with was from Montana or Oklahoma, they did searches in both those states. They found a record of a Lydia Mulch changing her name in Butte, Montana, about 6 months after she was last seen in West Virginia, I said. She changed her name to B. Townsend. Detective Sargent sat up, intent on what I was saying, but Box looked unimpressed. 6 months later, I said, B. Townsend marries Calvin Daly in Omaha and gets yet another name. Daly was a mining engineer. I don't have it confirmed yet, but I'm betting he worked in Buckhannon as a consultant around the time Lydia Mulch disappeared. It just all adds up. "Adds up to what?" Box cried. "Motive," I said.
"For whom?"
Sergeant asked.
"Thierry Mulch," I replied. "The son who's officially dead?" Box scoffed. "And the man who's taken my family," I said, keeping my cool and talking to Detective Sargent.
"Can't you see it, Jan? Rather than a mysterious intruder who leaves no evidence and no link to the crime, now you've got a homicidal son scorned and bent on revenge. He plans, waits for the night of a snowstorm, slips in, kills everyone in the house, and then vanishes without a trace." Sargent was staring off into the distance as she said,
"I do see it."
"Fuck, come on, Jan," Box began. "This is..."
Right, she said. It fits, Brian. Think about it. The ME said that B. Daly was the last to die.
I nodded. Mulch wanted her to feel it. He killed her family first, showed her the bodies, or maybe made her watch her husband and children die, and then he slit his own mother's throat. Chapter 60. There was an extended silence in the car. Down the street, a woman in her 30s came out of the house where I believed Thierry Mulch had slaughtered his mother and her second family. A little boy walked by the woman's side as she went to the mailbox, and she gave us a long glance before they went back in.
I still don't buy it, Box said at last.
Why not? Aaliyah asked. It looks obvious to me.
Yeah, Box said. Except there was another mass murder exactly like this one. You tell me you've got Mulch connected to that one, too, and I'll start believing that this dead guy is behind it all.
Smart man, I said.
Dr. Cross, Detective Sergeant began.
No, he's right, I said. I do need that, and I don't have it. Can we use a desk and a computer at your office?
Box said, Are you? It's the least we can do, Sergeant said.
25 minutes later, Aaliyah was working at a computer in the Homicide Bureau of the Omaha Police Department, and I was making phone calls. I called Ned Mahoney first, hoping we'd gotten some kind of match through the facial recognition software, but so far, he said, it was still searching. I told him about Mulch looking like a suspect in the Daly slayings.
Anything that links Mulch to the killings in Fort Worth? He asked.
Not yet, I said. I'll let you know. I called John Sampson next and brought him up to date. He was with our computer experts looking through the files of Preston Elliott, the dead programmer whose bones were found in the pigsty in rural Virginia.
Get anything yet? I asked.
Not so far, he admitted. But they found some encrypted files about an hour ago, so maybe we'll get lucky once they break them.
Then I called the Fort Worth Police Department looking for Detective J.P. Vincenti and found out he was now Lieutenant J.P. Vincenti.
Alex Cross, Vincenti said. Fuck, man, I am so fucking sorry about the world of shit that's whirling around you now, my brother.
Vincenti was smart and profane, and I liked him a lot. He'd come up from poverty and was a tireless worker and an all-around good guy. Appreciate it, J.P., I said. I need some help that might help you.
With what?
You ever hear the name Thierry Mulch come up during your investigations into the Monahan murders? After a pause, he said,
Name doesn't ring a fucking bell. Why? Who is he?
The son of B. Daly, and the son of a bitch who took my family. It took a while to explain. When I'd finished, Vincenti said,
Name doesn't click for me, but let me pull up the file.
Look for anything that connects the mother to Mulch or West Virginia or anything that sticks out.
I'll get back to you,
he promised and hung up. Detective Sergeant took us to an excellent steakhouse for dinner. The meat was amazing, Omaha, after all, but I had little appetite and turned down all offers of alcohol. I was trying to juggle so much at the same time that I couldn't chance anything that might cloud my judgment. Aaliyah looked exhausted around 9 o'clock when she said goodnight and went to one of the rooms we'd rented at the Hyatt. I felt exhausted and unsure of where to go or what to do next beyond flopping into a bed. There was the deadline for delivering video proof of a double killing. But Gloria Jones and her friend in L.A. were already putting something together. All I had to do, she said, was find a place to film my part in the fake murder sometime later the following day. There was nothing for me to do in the meantime. That frightened me. As long as I was moving, trying some new avenue of investigation, I was able to keep my family's situation from getting to me. Now, however, lying on my bed and staring at the ceiling, it came back down on me like a crushing force. Yes, there was hope that they were all still alive, but linking Mulch to the Daily murders had made me realize that he would not hesitate to kill my entire family when the time came. But when was that time? How long was he likely to keep playing me? Did I have enough time to find them? I considered a promise to God. I'd leave this life of constant investigation if my family were returned safely to me. But then I remembered something Nana Mama had told me back when I was 15 or 16. You can't bargain with God, Alex. You can state your good intentions. You can imagine the life you want. But you can't negotiate with him. He holds all the cards. Lying on the bed, I closed my eyes and imagined my family as vividly as I could. We were in the new addition. My arm was tight around Bree's waist, and I smelled her as if she were right there. Ali was pretending he was in a gunfight behind the new furniture. Janny was with Damon on the couch, laughing at their younger brother. Back in the kitchen, I saw a shadow, and my cell phone rang, a Texas area code. "You ready for this?" Lieutenant Vincenti said. Chapter 61. I sat up, turned on the light, said, "Go ahead, JP, I'm ready." "Okay," he said. "So Alice Monahan was born in Alaska, graduated from Deerfield Academy in Massachusetts, and did her undergrad and MBA at Rice University." "Smart lady," I said. "Very," he said and laughed. "That's why I almost missed it. Tell me. For some reason, we had her transcript from Deerfield under her maiden name," he said. "If I hadn't dropped the papers, I wouldn't have seen the bottom of the transcript and the fact that she attended high school in Buckhannon, West fucking Virginia, her freshman and sophomore years before transferring to Deerfield. Her father was a high-profile geologist who had a 2-year contract with the mines." My heart raced. Buckhannon. What was the likelihood of a coincidence like that? 2 women who lived in the same small town in West Virginia end up slain in the same gruesome manner. 1 million to 1? More like 10 million to 1. This was no coincidence. Mulch knew Alice Monahan. I was sure of it. But I wanted the evidence straight in my mind. What was Mrs. Monahan's maiden name?
Littlefield.
Years she attended Buckhannon High?
It took Vicente a few seconds, but he found it and told me. She and Mulch would have been in the same graduating class had she stayed, I said, feeling pieces starting to snap together.
And she was a great student, and so was Mulch. My guess is if we compare Mulch's transcripts with hers, they took classes together.
So you're thinking Alice did some mean girl shit to him and he took revenge?
It feels right, I replied. She's smart, well-to-do. He's smart and lives on a pig farm. Maybe, after the psychological release Mulch got killing his mother and her second family, his thoughts turned to Alice and her family.
Like his thoughts have now turned to you and yours.
The question unnerved me, but I said, "For whatever reason, JP."
"Hey, you know who you should talk to about Alice Monahan?"
"Who's that?"
"That fucking Harvard guy who wrote that book about the cases. What's his name?"
"Sunday," I said. "Marcus Sunday."
Chapter 62. Sunday sipped a double espresso and kept his eyes on the highway. It was already 10:30. He was 10 miles out of Little Rock, and he had a long ride ahead of him. But he welcomed the journey. "It's the drifter and the hunter in me," he thought. "I am simply one of those men born to roam and kill." He was also like the philosopher Epicurus, seeing good and evil linked with pleasure and pain. A good meal was pleasurable, and therefore good. A hangover showed the evil potential of wine. But his thoughts about the pleasure that could be derived from pain were more complex and contradictory. Indeed, as his mind drifted toward Acadia Leduc, he drove on feeling the pleasure of her coming pain and knowing that was going to be good. Very, very good. A smile crossed Sunday's face, and he glanced over at Cochran's laptop computer. It was the only thing he'd taken from the truck. Before leaving the rig, he'd wiped the interior down completely, shut the drapes, and then waited for an upsurge in activity at the truck stop. He left the truck idling, as sleeping drivers often do, doors locked, and strolled behind the convenience store looking for cameras. Seeing none there, Sunday slipped into the scrub pines that abutted the truck stop and headed south. He walked 5 miles and then trashed his trucking cap before calling a cab, which had brought him to an Enterprise. While waiting for the pickup he'd rented to be serviced, he'd gotten on the internet using Cochran's laptop and started monitoring 4 of his bank accounts, as well as all activities on his credit cards. In the past few hours, nearly $12,000 in cash had been taken from the accounts via ATMs in Memphis and across the river in Arkansas. Worse, close to $180,000 had been wire transferred to accounts in Mexico he'd never heard of. There was only one person who could have pulled this off. Only one person who could have gotten copies of his ATM cards, the passwords, and the bank account numbers and routing information for those wire transfers. Acadia. She was a bright, larcenous creature, wasn't she? He'd seen that she'd dropped the Malibu with Avis at the Memphis airport and then somehow gotten across the river to make the withdrawals. But how? He assumed she was using her own credit cards, but unfortunately, he had no way of getting into her accounts. That pissed him off. She thought to find out my numbers, he fumed, but I didn't think to learn hers. Which meant it was a crapshoot as to which of the 3 places he thought she might run to she'd actually gone. Before he could consider them each again, he heard a phone ring. It was his legitimate cell phone, the one he used in his professional and writing life. He dug it from his pocket, saw an unfamiliar number on the screen, wondered if it might be Acadia, and punched answer.
Marcus Sunday?
The man said. You're talking to him.
I'm sorry to interrupt your evening, but I got your number from your publicist in Los Angeles and...
Whom do you write for? Sunday asked. He'd had a flurry of stories written about him when the book came out, but none in months.
I don't write for anyone. This is Alex Cross. Do you remember me?
Chapter 63. For 3 slow beats, time stood still for Sunday, and for once in his life, no thoughts flickered in his brain.
Dr. Sunday?
Cross said.
Hello?
Then time and Sunday's mind lurched back into sync. Talk to Cross? Now this was interesting. Right here, Special Agent Cross, Sunday said. And of course I remember you.
I'm not with the Bureau anymore.
No, Sunday said, feeling excited, dueling. I hadn't heard that.
Look, I know you've got reason not to talk to me after the review I gave your book, but are you aware of my situation?
Situation? Sunday said with slight imperiousness. No, I've been overseas and have only just returned. What is your situation?
A guy named Thierry Mulch has killed several people in the D.C. area and has taken my family hostage.
Jesus, I'm sorry to hear that. I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy.
Thank you. Ever heard of him, Thierry Mulch?
Be calm, Sunday thought. Carry on smoothly. But what was Cross's game? How much did he know? How much should Sunday say? He decided to go on instinct, his intimate ally in the past. I can't say I've ever heard the name, as unusual as it is, Sunday replied. Who is he?
The son of B. Daly.
Sunday's mind whirled with the implications of that statement. Cross now had a link that, to Sunday's knowledge, no one else had. But that link in no way indicated that Cross had connected Mulch to Sunday. He was positive of that. You must be mistaken, Dr. Cross. B. Daly's son, Ross, died in the house with the rest of the family.
It turns out she had another son in another life before she met Daly.
What? Where? In Montana?
Buckhannon, West Virginia. B was Lydia Mulch back then. She met Calvin Daly when he worked as an engineer at a coal mine there and ran away with him, leaving her son behind. She changed her name legally in Montana and then moved to Omaha and married Calvin. That story she told people about being raised in Montana was fiction.
So what are you saying? You think this Thierry Mulch character killed the Daly family?
I do.
But the killer left no evidence. So you can't say for sure. Or can you?
Not good enough for a jury, if that's what you mean. But there's more. Alice Monahan? She was once Alice Littlefield.
Correct. Born in Anchorage, I think.
That's right. And she graduated from Deerfield Academy after spending 2 years in Buckhannon High School.
I didn't know that.
It was there in the evidence.
Cross sighed.
But no one attached any significance to it until now.
Well, Sunday said, making a point of sounding dejected. I guess my perfect criminal wasn't so perfect after all.
Oh, Mulch was close to perfect. Had all sorts of people believing he was dead for decades. No one suspects a ghost in a series of mass murders.
So, why exactly did you call me?
I don't know,
Cross admitted, sounding as if he was bearing a heavy burden.
J.P. Vincenti thought you might have come across something that we could use to help us find Mulch before he kills my family.
You don't know where this Mulch is?
We have no idea.
Cross sounded frustrated and sincere, and Sunday's shoulders relaxed before he said in a soothing voice, I'm afraid I can't help you, Dr. Cross. I'm terribly sorry, and sorry for your horrible, horrible situation.
Sorry I wasted your time.
You didn't waste my time. You actually did me a favor.
Yeah? How's that?
You gave me the heads up. I'm going to have to amend the book now. And I should probably start by researching Mr. Thierry Mulch and Buchanan, West Virginia. That was the name of the place, wasn't it?
Correct. And while you're at it, would you amend the quotes you attributed to me? They're not right.
You tell me how you want them to read, and I deeply apologize if I misquoted you. There was a silence before Cross said,
Apology accepted.
Good. Where are you, Dr. Cross, D.C.?
Omaha. You?
Memphis, for a reading. Last week was Philly, and after this, I'm headed to Austin. Say, would you agree to do an interview when this is all over? Cross hesitated, then said,
Sure.
With a tape recorder running. Maybe.
And hung up. Ignoring the dig, Sunday grinned, buzzing on the adrenaline his conversation with the detective had triggered, and the satisfaction he got knowing that even if Cross had learned of Thierry Mulch's past, he had no clue where to find Mr. Mulch now. Sunday clearly had the upper hand and was still two, maybe even three steps ahead. Laughing and gleefully pounding his fist on the steering wheel, Sunday put the gas pedal to the floor and shot forward through the night.
Chapter 64. I hung up the phone with Marcus Sunday, feeling like I'd hit yet another dead end. Why had I called him? If the FBI and police had never heard of Thierry Mulch in connection with the Monahan and Daly murders, why should I expect Sunday to have come across his name? Because you are grasping at straws, Alex. As soon as I had that thought, I got angry with myself. Damn right I was grasping at straws. My family had been gone for 10 days. For 10 days, Mulch had been playing me like I was a puppet and he was a cruel puppeteer. I would grasp at any straw, string, or thought if it might help me find Bree, Nana Mama, Damon, Janny, and Ali. It was nearing midnight, however, and I realized there was nothing else I could do, no other straws I could reach for. I put my phone on Do Not Disturb and fell into a deep sleep. I surfaced groggily shortly after 3 a.m., and then tried to force myself back to that deep, dark respite from reality. Instead, I was cast into dreams where I saw Mulch as that red-bearded guy who'd gone to Ali's school, slipping alongside the Daly's house in a snowstorm, carrying the knife that would kill the mother who had abandoned him. Mulch was inside then, a Grinch creeping past a glowing Christmas tree. He climbed the staircase, pushed open the first bedroom door. There were forms lying beneath the covers of a queen-size bed. When Mulch eased back the blankets, I saw that woman who now lived in the Daly's house. Beside her, my son, Ali, not her son, was curled up in a fetal position. Mulch put the blade to Ali's neck and pulled backward sharply. Blood misted the air. I screamed and spun in my dream, raced down the hallway to the next bedroom. But Mulch was somehow already there, and he was done with Damon and Janny. The hallway got longer as I ran on, trying to protect Bree. Mulch came out her door before I got there, and he smiled at the blood dripping off the knife before beckoning me to follow him to the last bedroom door. When I got there, he was standing by my grandmother, who looked exactly as she had the day she came to get me when I was 10, that loving but no-nonsense expression, her teacher's crisp posture, the blue dress she'd worn with a matching hat and handbag, and the white church gloves. As if unaware of Mulch raising the blade toward her throat, Nana Mama looked at me and said softly, "Alex, are you ready for a new life?" "No," I said. "No," my grandmother chided gently. "Then your thinking is wrong, young man. That's the difference between folks when it comes down to it. Their thinking defines them. So I'll ask you again. Are you ready for a new way of thinking?" "No," I screamed as the knife cut into her with a sound like thumping. "No!" The thumping became pounding in my brain so loud I thought my skull would split before I jolted awake, sweaty, and looked around the hotel room wildly. It was almost 5 a.m. The pounding startled me that time. Someone was knocking on my door. "Hold on!" I shouted, struggling to my feet and realizing I'd slept in my clothes. God only knew what I smelled like. At the door, I peered through the peephole and saw Tess Aaliyah moving like Janny had as a girl when she had to pee,
rocking from one agitated foot to another, her face screwed up in concentration. My stomach did a flip and I bowed my head, prayed, "Dear God, please give me the strength to handle whatever it is she has to tell me." Then I opened the door. "I thought you were dead for a second there," Detective Elias said with relief. "Don't you answer your phone?" I had it on Do Not Disturb. "What's going on?" "Mahoney and Sampson have been trying to call you the past hour," she replied. "They wanted to be the ones to tell you, but it is what it is." Her face broke into a smile. The facial recognition software got a solid hit on that photo of Carla Meps. Mahoney and Sampson think they know who she is. Chapter 65. The faces of Ned Mahoney and John Sampson filled the laptop screen. Aaliyah and I were in Aaliyah's room, linked to them through Skype. "The biometric analysis keyed on a Louisiana driver's license," Mahoney explained. "I'll send it over in a second." "Well, who is she?"
"Acadia LaDuke," Sampson said. "She's a former nurse turned freelance photographer. The New Orleans address on the license is old and we have nothing current, but her name, Acadia, came up in those encrypted files on Preston Elliott's computer. Elliott evidently did some work for an Acadia."
"Where?"
"Looks like D.C., my partner said. "The notes in the file said, Acadia, work complete, services owed, Calorama."
"When was the file created?"
3 months ago," Sampson said. "It was last updated 2 weeks ago."
I digested that, said, "So she was in D.C. just before my family was taken."
"Looks that way," Mahoney agreed. "We have access to her credit cards?"
"Not yet, but we're working on it."
"Ms. LaDuke have a record?" Aaliyah asked.
"Nothing as an adult," Sampson said. "But we got bounce back on her name in juvie files in, Jefferson Davis Parish, Louisiana."
"With your permission, we're going to put out a blanket bulletin on her," Mahoney said. "Every agent and police officer in the country will have seen the face of Acadia LaDuke by tomorrow."
At first, I thought that was a good idea, but then I balked.
"Can we wait on that a day? Find out more about LaDuke first?"
"Why?"
Sampson asked.
"I guess I'm nervous over what Mulch might do if we announce to the world that we've identified his accomplice." My partner glanced at Mahoney, who said,
"We'll do it your way."
"Thanks. Listen, I'll follow up on that juvenile report. Where was it?"
The FBI agent looked at his notes, said, "Jefferson Davis Parish. Courthouse is in the county seat, Jennings." With promises to keep my phone on and check in every hour, I ended the Skype call, looked at Aaliyah, and said, "I'm starving."
"I am too," she said.
We went downstairs to the hotel restaurant, and I ordered 4 eggs, toast, bacon, potatoes, and coffee. Aaliyah ordered oatmeal and fruit. While we waited for the food to come, I looked up the number for the Jennings, Louisiana Police Department on the internet, and then called. A female dispatcher answered. I identified myself and asked if there were any detectives or officers still around from the year that Acadia LaDuke got a sealed file in juvenile court. After a long pause, I was told I'd need to talk with the Jefferson Davis Parish Sheriff's Office. Our food came. Sensing that this might be a long, hard day, I ate it all before looking up the sheriff's phone number. The deputy who answered the phone said that Sheriff Paul Govan fit my search criteria, but he was at a training seminar and wouldn't be back for an hour or so. The deputy said he would give Sheriff Govan my number when he called in. Even though it was early, I called the court clerk in Jennings, Louisiana. Surprisingly, he answered the phone. Figuring I'd get shot down on the juvenile file, I asked if he could call up all civil and criminal files on anyone with the surname Leduc. A few moments later, he returned and said, "There's something from the late 90s on the girl, but it's sealed. There are two old lawsuits regarding land boundaries that are more than 20 years old, and there are several old criminal cases involving the father, but Jean, well, he has been dead for years, since the late 90s. The way the clerk said that last bit, emphasizing the late 90s, sounded odd, so I said, "How'd he die?" "His gators got him," the clerk replied. "Any more than that, you need to talk with the sheriff. He worked all that nasty business back then." The clerk hung up before I could get another word in, and I was left spinning my wheels, waiting for a call from Sheriff Gauvin, but wondering if the way the clerk had said the words, "the late 90s, was meant to tip me off that Acadia's sealed juvenile case had something to do with her father's death by gators. It kind of made twisted sense if that was so. Thierry Mulch had fed his father and Preston Elliott to the pigs, after all. How had Mulch and Acadia met? Did one monster sense the other and, what, confide? I'd seen it before, usually among male serial killers who'd taken on younger apprentices. But an alliance between monsters of different genders? I couldn't come up with an example of it, other than Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow, and that seemed a weak case at best, because they were bank robbers who happened to kill, not murderers who happened to kidnap.
Chapter 66. In a cranky, foul mood around 11:30 that morning, Sunday sat in the rented pickup truck watching a small tan bungalow down a side street in Corpus Christi, Texas. Summer had come early. It was blistering hot out, 92 in the shade, and humid beyond belief. Worse, he'd barely slept in the past 30 hours, and he'd been pissing in a bottle since leaving Memphis. He dozed off and on since arriving around 6:20, but he'd woken up whenever a car or pedestrian had passed, and he was sure that Acadia had not gone into the house. He was also positive that no one had left in the almost 5 hours he'd been sitting in the heat, turning the AC on every few minutes and wanting to punch out the window. There was always the possibility that Acadia had gotten here first and had put her car in the garage before 6:20. Or he could have guessed wrong. But when he'd considered the three places she'd be most likely to head in times of turmoil, he'd followed his gut and come here first. How long should he give it? His head was starting to spin and pound, and he knew he was in no condition to make decisions. He'd have to give in and sleep. Sunday was just about to turn on the car and the AC and shut his eyes for an hour when, in the rearview mirror, he spotted a green Mini Cooper turning onto the street. He immediately slid across the bench seat, head down, and waited until the Mini passed. Then he glided out the passenger door and galloped down the sidewalk wearing blue shorts, a sleeveless tee, running shoes, sunglasses, and a visor pulled down low over his eyes. The Mini slowed. The bungalow's garage door rose as the car turned into the short uphill drive. Sunday slowed too, eyes patrolling the suburban street and seeing it deserted in the blistering heat of the day. When the Mini's nose passed into the garage, he took one last glance around and exploded diagonally toward it. The Mini was inside. The door engaged and began to lower. Sunday dove over the security beam and then barrel-rolled into the garage. A second later, he was crouched behind the left rear bumper, and the garage was closed off from the street. Sunday froze as the driver's door opened and shut, and he heard footsteps walking across the floor to a set of wooden stairs. A key turned in a lock. The door opened and stood ajar. Sunday heard the first beep and made his move, dancing along and around the front of the Mini and up the steps as more beeps echoed in the garage. A loud buzz sounded, signaling that the security code had turned off the system. In a heartbeat, Sunday was through the door and on her from behind, clamping one hand over her mouth before she had the chance to scream and driving her across the hallway and up against the wall. He ground his hips hard against her rear and pushed his face close to the left ear of a terrified red-headed woman dressed in purple hospital scrubs. "Hello, Jillian," he growled. "Just getting off shift?" Chapter 67. A former classmate of Acadia's in nursing school and the closest his ex-lover had to a best friend forever, Jillian Green squealed into Sunday's hand, sounding so much like a sow going to slaughter that he almost laughed. "Where's Acadia?" he snarled. "And if you scream or lie, I will hurt you. I don't want to, but I will. Do you understand?" Tears welled in Jillian Green's eyes, and she nodded, trembling. "Please, Marcus," she whined when he removed his hand and turned her to face him. Jillian was thick and busty, not at all his type, but he was still happy to press against her with his forearm across her throat and say, "Where's my girl?"
"I don't know," Jillian said desperately. "I haven't heard from her in weeks."
"Wrong answer," Sunday said, pressing his arm harder against her throat and grabbing one of her pinkies. "Now, try again, or I will snap this finger and then another before I crush your larynx. Do you understand, Jillian?" She was weeping again, but she nodded. Sunday released the pressure on her throat but held her pinky firmly. Jillian sobbed.
"Don't hurt her, please."
"Hurt her?" he said, acting taken aback. "I'm not interested in hurting Acadia any more than I'm interested in hurting you, Jillian. I just want the money she stole from me yesterday. I want it back in my account, and then I'm moving on. No hard feelings. Truth is, she and I have been on the outs for a while now, and while I can take the abandonment, I cannot abide a thief."
"You promise you won't hurt her?"
"On my dear mama's soul," Sunday assured her. Jillian swallowed, said, "Last I knew, around midnight, just as I was going on shift, she had car trouble and said she wouldn't be coming here after all." "Okay," he said reasonably. "Where did she say she was going?"
"Her apartment in New Orleans," she said, a little too quickly.
Sunday could spot a liar a mile away, much less 6 inches. He smiled, said, "So she's going to her mother's?" A wave of fear pulsed through Jillian's face.
"Marcus, no, she..."
He pressed against her throat again, said, "Shh, now. No more of that. I'm going to need a place to sleep for a few hours. I can crash here, right?"
"That's not a good..."
He increased the pressure on her throat again, and she gulped and nodded. Sunday released her and let her lead the way. As they crossed through a small, tidy kitchen, he saw her hesitate as she passed a block of knives on the counter. "Don't even think about that, darling," he said.
"What? I was wondering if you were hungry."
He was, but that could wait. He said, "I just want to sleep for now. I'll eat later, and then you'll be rid of me." From the stiffness of her posture as they entered the hall, Sunday knew she was having a hard time believing him. But that was okay. He was having a hard time believing it himself. Jillian stopped, gestured through an open door, said,
"There's an extra bed in there you can use."
"No, no," he said, pushing her forward. "I was thinking we'd sleep together so I'd know if you got up or tried to make a phone call."
"I wouldn't,"
she said, her voice cracking as she went through the door at the end of the hall. "Just the same," Sunday said, following her into the master bedroom, a tasteful and orderly space with a decidedly feminine touch.
I need to take a shower, she said.
That's a great idea, he said. But later, after.
Jillian turned and, without meeting his eye, said, After?
Come on now, darling, you take off those scrubs. Show Marcus what he's been missing. And he'll show you what Acadia has been getting, he said.
Please, Marcus, she whimpered.
Take them off, he said, or I'll tear them off you.
Looking humiliated, she shed the top and bottom, and then took off her bra and panties.
Well, Jillian, I must say, you've exceeded my expectations, Sunday said, shucking his running shorts.
You're an Aphrodite, as Rubens might have painted her, pale and voluptuous.
Now, lie face down on the bed and let old Marcus go to work on you.
You watch. It'll relieve the unnecessary tension between us, Jillian. It'll help us both get a great afternoon snooze.
Chapter 68. Tessa Leah and Alex Cross checked out of the hotel shortly after noon and headed to the airport. It was Cross's idea to set up there, and Aaliyah agreed with the strategy. If they had a break of any kind anywhere in the country, they wanted to be able to move as fast as possible. They went to a cafe inside the airport and spent nearly 5 hours there, drinking coffee, eating, and reviewing every aspect of the case. They identified questions they wanted answered, and let their imaginations and investigative instincts paint the space between what they knew and what they didn't know about Thierry Mulch and Acadia Leduc. The more time Detective Aaliyah spent with Cross, the more she respected him. An ordinary man, cop or otherwise, faced with this kind of pressure, would have buckled long ago. But Cross just seemed to shrug the weight from one shoulder to the other, bearing the load with a grace she couldn't imagine. Based on his accomplishments, Cross could easily have been a know-it-all or a pompous ass, yet he was an excellent listener, gave of himself, and didn't seem to have an egotistical cell in his formidable body. He also displayed a remarkable ability to compartmentalize. Though he and Aaliyah were talking about things that directly affected the lives of his family, Cross seemed able to divorce himself from what had to be disturbingly emotional aspects of the case and keep working the investigation rationally and logically. When Aaliyah came back after a bathroom break around 4:45, Cross said, "We'll give it another couple of hours, then find a hotel again. What about the video of the killing you're supposed to make? Gloria Jones is supposed to call me when she's ready for me," Cross said. "On another note, how's your dad's hip these days?" As a general rule, Detective Aaliyah did not discuss her dad without his permission, but Bernie was an admirer of Cross's work, and she didn't think he'd mind. "I don't know if you know, but the entire right side of his pelvis was shattered," she said. "He gets around okay after 4 operations, but you can tell it still bothers him." "The hip or not being on the job?" She smiled. "Both." "I remember what a machine he was," Cross said. "Must have made him crazy to be done with his career, I mean." "Oh, it did at first," Aaliyah said. "I thought he was going to drive my mother insane, and he abused alcohol for a bit, but then Mom got sick and she became the focus of his life until she passed last year."
"I'm sorry to hear that. What does your dad do with his time now?"
"He fishes a lot and putters in the yard, and he's got a lady friend."
"You okay with that?"
Aaliyah cocked her head, reappraised him, and said,
"So, it is true you've got telepathy and X-ray vision."
Cross chuckled.
"Just a knack for reading body language."
"Then you should go play poker in Vegas."
"Does that mean you're not okay with his lady friend?"
God, he was good, she thought. Gentle, but relentless.
I've met her only once, Aaliyah replied. She's nice, and I don't know. I guess I don't want to see my dad hurting anymore.
Well, that's perfectly understandable, Cross said. And it must be tough for you because he's struggling toward normalcy and you're not a part of it on a day-to-day basis.
Aaliyah hadn't thought of it that way before, but she nodded, realizing that Cross had a vast reserve of emotional intelligence as well as an analytical side.
His cell rang at 5:30. Cross answered, listened, and said,
Yes, Sheriff, this is Alex Cross.
What can you tell me about Acadia LeDuc?
He listened again, then said, I understand that it was sealed. You should know, however, that D.C. Metro Police and the FBI consider her an accomplice in a kidnapping and murder spree.
Cross nodded at Aaliyah and then listened without comment for nearly 15 minutes. Finally, he said,
No, I wish you'd hold off on that until I can get there. But in the meantime, you should put that cabin under surveillance, and I'll let you know our ETA once I get a better handle on how we're going to do this.
Then Cross hung up, looking energized again, and said, We need to get to Jennings, Louisiana, the quickest way possible.
Chapter 69. In Jillian's green condo in Corpus Christi, Marcus Sunday awoke refreshed and with a pleasant, dull ache in his loins. He checked his watch, yawned, and got to his feet naked. Sunday left the bed in a shambles, with the blankets in a heap and long, thin tears in the sheets, as if fingernails had gouged them. He pushed open the bathroom door and smelled bleach. He cocked his head, appreciating the sight of Acadia's BFF lying in the bathtub, water up to her neck, her eyes still bugged out from having been choked with his belt, as he fucked her from behind. He'd heard that being strangled during sex causes stronger orgasms in some women, and he decided to experiment. Jillian certainly proved the point, he thought. She'd gone off into la-la land there at the end, quivered unbelievably just before she died. Sunday turned on the shower, waited until it warmed, and then climbed into the chill water with the dead woman. He paid the corpse no mind as he washed himself head to toe with antibacterial soap. When he was done, he pushed her head under the bleach water. After 3 minutes, he pulled the plug on the tub, stepped out onto the mat, and dripped dry while using a washcloth to hold the shower head and rinse Jillian's body with cold water. When he was done, he poured 3 capfuls of Drano into the drain, wiped down the shower controls with the washcloth, and brought it and the bath mat to the master bedroom. Sunday stripped the bed, took the sheets and blankets to the washing machine. He put them in and added 1/2 cup of Clorox before turning it on hot. He wiped down the machine knobs and found the vacuum. He vacuumed from the edge of the tub back into the master bedroom and then put on his running gear again. Then he cleaned his way out of the house, back through the kitchen, and into the garage. After removing the vacuum cleaner bag, he wiped down the vacuum with the damp washcloth, and then set the machine in a corner, as if it were always kept there. With the washcloth, he pressed the garage door opener, waited until it was completely up. A kid on a bicycle went past, but didn't look his way. Sunday stabbed the switch and took off, vaulting over the top of the stairs, sprinting along the Mini Cooper, then hurdling the security beam. He was down the street and in the rented truck 30 seconds later. He dumped the vacuum bag at a rest stop out on I-10, heading east.
Chapter 70. A wide swath of violent weather swept across the southern plains that evening. Thunderstorms delayed our takeoff and landing, so it was 8 before we stepped off a United Airlines jet in Houston. The ride had been a rodeo,
and there was talk of tornado activity throughout the night from eastern Texas into western Louisiana, which, unfortunately, was where we were headed. I'm praying this isn't a wild goose chase, Aaliyah said as I drove a rented Jeep Cherokee out of the airport into a pelting rain. It's the strongest straw we've got to grasp at, I said. Put Jennings in the GPS. She did, and the machine told us we had a 178-mile road trip ahead of us. Luckily, most of the way would be on Interstate 10. We theoretically could be there around 10:30. But wind and rain buffeted the car and slowed us. Was this trip worth it? Was it worth risking the drive at night with all the weather warnings? I still thought so after going over what Sheriff Govan had told me over the phone. Govan had been new to the force the night Acadia LeDuc called in the accidental death of her father. Like Thierry Mulch's father, Jean LeDuc had a reputation for violence and booze. He'd beaten his wife and daughter several times, but both had refused to testify against the man. The mother had a fresh black eye when Govan and the sheriff arrived on the scene, a cabin on the banks of a bayou outside Jennings. Early one morning after a torrential rain, Acadia and her mother said Jean LeDuc had gotten wildly drunk the evening before and took it out on his wife before she and her daughter managed to barricade themselves in the windowless back room, their usual method of surviving his tirades. They claimed to have spent the entire night there. Acadia went searching for her father when they found the cabin and shed empty. She went down by the dock, expecting to find him passed out on his airboat, a common enough occurrence. Then she heard a commotion in the pen where her father kept his pet alligators. All that was left was his right forearm, which conveniently had an identifying tattoo on it, Govan had said. That and other evidence I won't get into led us to believe that Acadia and her mother, or Acadia acting on her own, killed old Jean and then fed him to the alligators. But we could never prove it, and most folks around here said good riddance. Acadia left Jennings after graduation and moved to New Orleans to enter a nursing program at Loyola. That was a while back, but the sheriff said he saw her several times a year when she came to visit her mother. So the mom knows how to get in touch with her? I'd asked. Expect so, he said. If she got in trouble, would she head there, to her mom's? She might, Govan said. What's the LeDuc place like? The house is a dump, but there are outbuildings and the property's big, the sheriff said. And it's on the Bayou de Cane, isolated. There isn't another house around there for a mile, maybe more. It was, in short, the kind of place a madman like Mulch might keep five hostages. The sheriff offered to go out to LeDuc's mother's to ask some questions and have a look around, but I asked him not to, saying that I wanted to be there in case that was where my family was being held. Instead, I asked that the road into the place be monitored. Shortly after 10, the rain eased somewhat, and I was able to relax my death grip on the wheel. The rain had been falling in sheets, and the glare off the wet road was forcing me to squint when my cell phone rang again. Chapter 71. It was Ned Mahoney. I answered and put the phone on speaker. Alex, Mahoney said, where are you now? I glanced at Aaliyah, who said, about 10 miles west of Beaumont. Your hunch about LeDuc's mom might be paying off, Mahoney said. We got access to LeDuc's credit cards. About 5 hours ago, she bought gas in Natchitoches. 4 hours before that, she bought gas and food in Texarkana. She's driving a blue 2014 Dodge Avenger rental and heading in your direction. I sped up and ignored the rain, which had started falling hard again.
Any pictures from gas stations?
Aaliyah said.
We've made the request, Samson said.
I said, can you get the rental agency to track the car's GPS?
We've made that request too, said Mahoney.
Hertz wants to comply, but they need to see a search warrant, which is being worked on as we speak.
Where was she before Texarkana? I asked. She spent quite a bit of time in D.C. the past few months, Samson said, in and around Kalorama.
We have an address? Aaliyah asked.
There's nothing under her name.
Any other travel outside the district? I asked.
Lots, Mahoney said. She was in a mystery bookstore in Philadelphia last Tuesday, and at the airport in St. Louis on Friday. On Saturday, she was back east, buying food at a restaurant in Cumberland, Maryland.
Wait, Aaliyah said.
What time did she buy the food in Cumberland?
There was a pause before Samson said,
10:12. She charged $18 and change at, Cafe Mark on Baltimore Street.
That's not 20 miles from Frostburg, Aaliyah said. And it fits with the time Claude Harrow was killed and his place torched.
I thought so too, Tess, Samson said.
You talked to anyone at that cafe? I asked.
Closed until 7 tomorrow morning, Mahoney said. Any other purchases? Aaliyah asked.
Yeah, Samson said. Later Saturday afternoon, she charged $60 at the Harris Teeter Food Market on Kalorama Avenue and $37 at Secundi, a used clothes consignment shop in DuPont Circle.
Walkable from Kalorama, I said.
Easily, Mahoney agreed.
Maybe that's where Mulch is holding them, Aaliyah said. It was entirely possible. Again and again in the past few months, Acadia LeDuc had returned to that neighborhood in my city to do her spending. She'd clearly been living in the area. With Mulch? I guessed yes. But why had she gone to St. Louis? And why was she in Louisiana now?
What about this past Sunday? Aaliyah asked.
She didn't charge anything on that date, but she was busy yesterday, Samson said. She bought an early breakfast at Reagan National and then rented the Dodge at the Memphis airport about 4 hours after she landed. Last night she bought gas and got a room at the Hampton Inn in Fort Smith, Arkansas, then nothing until the gas buy in Texarkana.
I barely heard the last part of the report. My mind had rocketed back nearly 24 hours, and my hands began to shake.
John, I said in a trembling voice, just to confirm, you said she got the car at the Memphis airport? And you said she bought something in a Philadelphia mystery bookshop?
Both correct, my partner said.
My hand shot to my mouth, and the car swerved so hard I had to take my foot off the gas and hit the brakes.
Jesus, Aaliyah said. What the?
I think I know who Thierry Mulch is, I said. Or is now, anyway. Their voices came back as one.
What? Who?
Marcus Sunday, I said, feeling rage building inside me. That Harvard guy who wrote that book about the Daly and Monahan killings. The perfect criminal. Jesus Christ, the egomaniacal son of a bitch was writing about himself.
Part 4.
Chapter 72. Acadia LeDuc had timed her approach so it was pitch black and pouring when she took the Evangeline Highway exit off Interstate 10. She headed north around and away from Jennings, Louisiana for 9 miles, and then turned the Dodge rental onto a muddy two-track path that she bounced along for several hundred yards across the top of a dike before parking where a rice field met a swamp. When Acadia was a girl,
She'd roamed for miles in these swamps. Now